Hi, I'm Julia Serrano. This recording is a companion piece to my article, A Matter of Perspective, a Transsexual Woman-Centric Critique of Alice Dreger's Scholarly History of the Bailey Controversy. That critique is also downloadable from the same location that you probably found this recording, which is my TS Etiology page on my website, juliaserrano.com. This format gives me the chance to discuss some additional points that I didn't have a chance to cover in that essay, and it also provides an informal venue for me to share some of my more personal thoughts and emotions that I've experienced in response to this controversy within a controversy. So I should probably begin with a few disclaimers. I'm going to assume that listeners are already somewhat familiar with Blanchard's theory, Bailey's book, Dreger's article, and other aspects of trans politics. I also really, really highly encourage you to read my aforementioned essay first. Basically, that critique, I feel, is the best, tightest, most succinct critique of Alice Dreger's article that I could come up with, and what you're going to be hearing on this is kind of like bonus stuff, or B-sides, or extras of different sorts related to that. I also will be pronouncing some names that I've never pronounced before, so I apologize in advance if I mispronounce anyone's name. I'll be citing page numbers from Dreger's preprint, which is numbered from 1 to 62. I'm not sure if these pages will be the same in the final publication, so if they differ, you may have to do some addition or subtraction to figure out what page I'm referring to. Okay, so here's the final disclaimer. This here is not meant to be an academic critique, but an informal, personal one. As a trans woman, I can't pretend to be emotionally detached from this subject. Like many trans women, I feel that Bailey's book and rhetoric dismisses my identity, erases my life experiences, and reinforces my marginalization. In short, his book triggers me. And Dreger's retelling of this controversy, especially the way she discounts and sometimes even mocks trans women's concerns about Bailey's book, is both insulting and demeaning. Personally, the passage of her article that resonated with me the most is on page 47, when she describes something that Angelica Kyle-Tika said. So she's the trans woman who is depicted in Bailey's book under the pseudonym Cher. So Kyle-Tika was angry about the fact that Bailey portrayed her as an autogonophile, and she said that she felt that it constituted a subreption, which Dreger defines as, quote, a misrepresentation of her identity so absolutely gross as to constitute a virtual theft of her true identity, end quote. Now, as someone who has the privilege of not having been depicted in Bailey's book, despite that fact, I think that word pretty much captures how a lot of trans women feel about Bailey's depictions of us, and how a lot of lesbian and bisexual identified trans women's feelings about being non-consensually labeled as autogynephiles. Bailey's book forwards hypersexualized caricatures of trans women, and in a world where few trans women have any voice in academia or in the media or in sexology, Bailey's depictions stand in for us. They invisibilize us. They erase us. In my peer commentary, I tried to keep my frustration and anger at bay. That represents my academic response to Bailey's book and Dreger's article. This here is my personal response, and I will not be repressing my emotions here. While I promise not to indulge in personal attacks, as I don't know Dreger or Bailey personally, I will be directly confronting their ideas and their writings in a no-holds-barred fashion. I think it's unfair for people to expect trans women to tone down our emotions and our rhetoric in these debates. After all, it's our identities that are on the line here, our identities that are being debated, not theirs. We are on unequal footings in this matter, and insisting that I hide my anger or frustration only serves to invisibilize their cissexual privilege. And so also, by the way, throughout this recording, I'll be using the word cissexual as a synonym for non-transsexual. And so therefore, if you're not a transsexual, then you're cissexual. And when I talk about cissexual privilege, that's analogous to heterosexual privilege. So in a heterosexist world, heterosexual attraction and relationships are seen as valid and are taken for granted, while same-sex attraction and relationships are not. Similarly, in a cis-sexist world, cissexual gender identities and lived experiences are seen as valid and are taken for granted, while transsexual ones are not. Bailey and Drager's assumptions and arguments about trans women, our perspectives and our politics, are enabled by their cissexual privilege, the fact that they can take their own male and female identities for granted in a way that we cannot. I assure you that if they were in a position where their male and female identities were regularly delegitimized and sexualized in a day-to-day basis, they would be as offended as we are about this. Okay. So as you can probably guess, when I first read Alice Drager's article, The Controversy Surrounding the Man Who Would Be Queen, A Case History of the Politics of Science, Identity, and Sex in the Internet Age, when I first read it back in August 2007, it made me really intensely angry. I feel that it's a classic example of everything that's been historically wrong with cissexual researchers who feel that their academic degree and credentials give them the expertise and the insight to just dive into transsexual lives and politics without having experienced them firsthand and somehow make sense of it all, to be able to make objective claims about our daily realities and such. Since Drager's been very active in ISNA, which, for those who don't know, is the Intersex Society of North America, here's what I hope is an apt analogy. On many occasions, I've called out people I know who operate under the false assumption that just because they are transgender or transsexual, or because they've taken or taught a gender studies class, that they automatically have some kind of insight or understanding of intersex lives and politics. I don't think that knowing something from the outside is the same as knowing it from the inside. While I consider myself an intersex ally, and have several intersex friends, and am probably more aware of intersex issues than 99% of the population, I still haven't had an intersex experience myself. And I most definitely haven't had the experiences that dedicated intersex activists have had, of speaking with countless intersex people, their parents, doctors who have intersex clients, experts on the legal aspects of intersexuality, and so on. In other words, I know a few facts about intersex, but not enough to see the big picture. It would be arrogant of me to chime in on important intersex issues, such as how intersex children should be raised with regard to gender, or whether the term disorders of sex development should be adopted or not, given the fact that I cannot see the big picture, and I'm not personally affected by those issues or terminology. In other words, I have the privilege of not having to deal with intersex on a day-to-day basis, and that automatically makes any comments or claims that I make politically convenient, and I would argue, therefore, highly suspect. That's why I don't arrogantly project my assumptions and beliefs onto intersex activism. Instead, I try to be the best ally I can be. I listen to what intersex people have to say about their own lives. I refrain from exploiting, appropriating, or interjecting myself into their issues and politics. By the same line of reasoning, the only people who truly understand transsexuality are trans people. I know a number of non-trans people who get it, who are excellent and knowledgeable trans activists, and they got to that place by truly listening to us. Some of them are partnered to trans people. Some have trans friends. Some have jobs that involve them interacting with the trans community. In any case, what makes them knowledgeable is the fact that they have listened to us. And not just one of us, or 10 of us, or 20 of us, but lots of us. And not just by conducting superficial interviews, but gaining our trust over time so that we might open up to them and share with them the truth of our lives. And they didn't just hear what they wanted to hear, but they listened and accepted to the parts that didn't make immediate sense to them, the parts that contradicted their own initial cissexual presumptions. They made a point of immersing themselves in the complexities and diversity of trans people's lives and politics, rather than merely projecting their interest and issues onto us. Frankly, even as a trans person, the first 3 years that I was involved in trans politics, I was constantly impressed by how little I really knew. The trans community is so extremely politically and experientially diverse, and there's absolutely no way that someone can digest and understand it all by doing research for a year or two. Even now, after having interacted with hundreds of trans people, having been to countless of trans events, reading scores of books penned by trans authors, listening to trans podcasts and reading trans blogs, and trading emails in numerous trans-themed email groups, and having intimate one-on-one conversations with trans friends who've shared with me things that they would never in a million years share with a gatekeeper or an academic researcher, even now, I still stumble onto new viewpoints and ideas on a weekly basis. But most people never see any of this. In science and academia, trans people are blank screens upon which cissexual researchers project their own thoughts and opinions and theories upon. I often get angry when I read cissexual sociologists or feminist critiques of transsexuality or trans politics, because more often than not, they're just projecting their privileges and biases onto us, unencumbered by the fact that they are not trans themselves. Similarly, many scientists, psychologists, and sexologists do the very same. What pisses trans people off about Bailey and Blanchard and the like is the fact that they think they know us. They think they can sit in their offices and superficially talk to the trans people who enter, or hook electrodes up to our genitals, or go out to some tranny nightclub and observe us, and they think they can gain insight into us in that way. It's naive. It's inane. It's like attempting to fully understand everything there is to know about a family, their daily lives, their interactions, their personal dynamics, by watching how they behave together in public. It's completely silly. Like I said before, some non-trans researchers and writers get it right, but when they do, it's because they really truly want to understand us, and they listen to what they have to say. What made me so angry about Drager's article was how dismissive it was of trans women's perspectives on the issue. She didn't listen. She didn't want to listen. She only heard what she wanted to hear. It seems really clear from her blog I write in Fear post and her recounting of personal incidents that led to her beginning her investigation that she was driven primarily, if not exclusively, by desire to shed light on what she considered to be the heavy-handed tactics used by Andrea James and others. In order to tell that story in the uncomplicated manner in which she apparently wanted, she had to ignore the institutionalized power that Bailey as a psychologist holds over trans people, and to dismiss trans women's legitimate concerns about Bailey's book. While she clearly tried to give the impression that she was being objective in her approach, and while this might fool readers who have only a limited knowledge of the controversy, anyone who's familiar or sympathetic with trans female perspectives on this issue can clearly see that this is mostly a smokescreen. As I described in my commentary, and we'll discuss further here, her article is heavily invested in dismissing and discounting trans women's perspectives, and for this reason, it contributes to our marginalization. So anyway, as I said before, I've written this critique, and hopefully you've read this by now. And what this is there are lots of other points that I wanted to make that I didn't have space for in that commentary. So for the rest of this recording, I'm going to delve into those details and discuss some of the many other concerns that I have with her article. So you should be aware beforehand that this will be somewhat long. I would imagine it'll be somewhat over an hour. And I'm going to break this down into three sections. And so the first section is going to be thoughts about how she spins the story. So this will cover her omissions, exaggerations, and manipulations of language that steer underinformed readers toward the viewpoint that Bailey is a nice, reasonable, albeit politically incorrect guy who has a scientifically valid viewpoint, and that trans woman activists were uninformed and irrationally upset by the book. This aids in giving the impression that he was unfairly attacked. This is crucial because if Drager acknowledged that Bailey's book contributed to trans women's marginalizations, readers would not sympathize with him and may even think that he had it coming to him. And they would see the trans women who are involved as defending themselves against the book, and therefore their actions might seem more legitimate than they're portrayed in the book, where they just seem to be completely irrational and beyond the pale is how she spins it. So that's the first section. The second section is talking about where she's downright wrong. And this is particularly with regards to the idea that three people Lynn Conway, Andrew James, and Deirdre McCloskey, who I'll sometimes refer to as CJM, which is kind of an inside joke that I'll explain later, that CJM choreographed the entire backlash. And kind of the ideas that's in there about the trans community being really monolithic. I think that she totally got that wrong in a really, 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 really just flat out wrong way. As inarticulate as that was right there. So that's section two. And then the third section, I'll discuss her hypocrisy. So those are the three sections. And also during this recording, because it's a little bit long, I'll be taking sips of beverage now and again, for example, now. So, okay, we're going to embark onto section one, spin. So, her article is chock full of firsthand quotes from Bailey that make him seem really likable. He's a family man. He's someone who respects and genuinely likes trans women. None of the trans women depicted in her article are humanized in the same way, except perhaps Anne Lawrence. And in fact, some of the main characters, the two main trans women activists who are basically the focus of a lot of her investigation, if you want to call it that, are Lynn Conway and Andrew James. She didn't bother interviewing Andrew James, so Andrew James has no voice in the article, and Lynn Conway wasn't interviewed because Lynn Conway didn't trust her and didn't return her phone calls and wanted to have nothing to do with that. So basically, there's this complete lack of humanization of the trans women, and that enables them to be viewed as irrational monsters. And the idea of, like, trannies as monsters is kind of this trope that's been around forever. It's been around since Psycho and Silence of the Lambs and Dress to Kill, etc. And so I'll be talking about that a little bit later, how she kind of plays into that trope. So often, Dreger almost verbatim Ford's Baileyisms, that is, things that he says himself to justify or defend himself. So, for example, she buys into this idea that he's attacked because he's politically incorrect, rather than because he's arrogant and wrong with regard to his views on trans women. She also uncritically plays the he's attacked by both sides card. And in order to give you an idea of what I mean by that, there's a passage in Bailey's book, okay, where he portrays Ken Zucker, who Ken Zucker is not only the editor of Archives of Sexual Behavior that's printing her article along with my critique and other people's critiques. But anyway, Bailey portrays Ken Zucker, who's most famous for his behavioral modification work that he does on gender nonconforming children. Bailey portrays him as moderate, simply because he's disliked on the left by gay rights supporters, and he's also disliked on the right by anti-homosexual conservatives. So when I first read that passage, I had to make this double take, because it struck me so much as, like, fifth grader logic. And what I mean by that is, like, logic that it gives the appearance of being logical, but it's not if you look more closely. This is the same thing that politicians always do, where they kind of paint themselves out as moderate, read reasonable, and therefore they characterize their opponents as being extremists, right? And, you know, this doesn't necessarily have anything to do with who's right or wrong or whose views are the best or most justified, right? This is just about portraying people as moderate so everyone else looks like extremists. And Dreger uses this same tactic in order to make Bailey look moderate. So according to Dreger, Bailey is neither a social constructionist or a biological determinist. He's neither pro-gay nor anti-gay. He's neither pro-trans nor anti-trans. And, you know, all of this kind of makes it seem like, oh, he must be really reasonable because he's not any of these, like, extreme positions. He's somewhere in the middle. And of course, once again, this has nothing to do with whether he's right or wrong, with whether what he said or written about trans women is justified or not. The only purpose it serves is to make him appear more moderate. Further, Dreger paints transsexuals who oppose his views as extremists. So she does this over and over again, but probably the one that really stands out that I think is the most illustrative example of this is on pages 21 and 22. where she kind of goes into this big section where she mocks Andrew James for this flowchart that she had that supposedly showed connections between Bailey and links to other institutions and possibly to eugenics and stuff like this, right? And so she purposely poos-poos this and makes James paint her out like she's this, she's just this conspiracy theorist and just really extreme interviews. She makes her look silly. And frankly, while I haven't seen that flowchart myself, and I can't say that I share all of Andrew James' views on everything having to do with this controversy, I will say that if you read Andrew James' article, A Defining Moment in Our History, which you can find just by Googling it, if you do that, you'll see that her views on these issues are far more articulate and cogent than Dreger ever gives her credit for. In fact, I'll bet that most trans and queer activists and feminist theorists that I know would probably agree with most, if not all, of the points that Andrew James makes in that essay. And yet, you know, that aspect of it never shows up in Dreger's article. It's just James is this kind of insane person who's a conspiracy theorist and who threatens people, right? That's like, that's kind of, you know, this really two-dimensional caricature of her that's shown. And this allows Dreger to kind of dismiss a lot of the very real and serious points that James and others makes. At nearly every turn, Dreger puts the best possible spin on Bailey's views and comments. For example, she plays down the fact that he forwards a pathologizing view of trans womanhood by saying that he likes trans women, and he supports autogynephiles having surgery. She plays down as many sexualizing and sexist remarks about trans women, especially his comments about trans women being especially well-suited for prostitution, by saying that he's not against prostitution or sex workers. Gee, thanks for pointing that out. You're right. Bailey isn't so bad after all. Sorry for the sarcasm. Okay, I'm not really sorry. Hi, that's Flutie Millar, by the way. If you hear meowing, that's my kitty sidekick, Flutie Millar. Okay, so anyway, where was I? Oh yeah, the sarcasm. Okay, so another bit of spin occurs on page 23, where she tries to make the case that many queer scholars gave the book positive reviews. Notably, aside from Anne Lawrence, who I'll get back to in a minute, all of these other queer scholars are gay men. So the last time I checked, gay men haven't had a trans female experience, so the passages that trans women find disturbing are likely not to even faze them. Second, Dreger seems to push this idea that gay men, who are also a subject of the book, were not nearly as bothered by the book as trans women. The implication here seems to be that trans women were justifiably upset by what Bailey said, because after all, it didn't bother gay men. What she never mentions is that psychologists like Bailey, as gatekeepers, hold institutional power over trans women that they do not hold over gay men. After all, psychologists get to decide whether we're allowed to transition or not. They don't hold any kind of similar power over gay men. Further, if someone in the media wanted to do a show on transsexuality, they'd most likely include the opinions of psychological experts. And in fact, this happens all the time, in documentaries and in news programs and so on. But if they were to do a program on gay people, we all know that they wouldn't bother interviewing any psychologists, because psychologists are no longer seen as having any kind of authority or expertise regarding gay people. Gay people are seen as experts on gay people, right? The same is not true for transsexuality. So, because gay people are not underneath the institutionalized power of psychologists and sexologists like Bailey, and because they have more of a voice in society and in the media, and they're seen as experts on themselves, there's no way that Bailey's views could possibly marginalize them in the way that it marginalizes trans women. So another Baileyism that Dreger seems to buy, that she seems to buy into, is this idea that trans women are in denial about their sexualities, or that we're all prudes for not wanting to talk about it. You know, this criticism really, really bugs the shit out of me, frankly. And the reason is because it's really, really super heterocentric. Because if you are in queer communities, and if you know trans people in queer communities, most of the trans women I know in queer communities are totally outspoken about their sexualities and have reclaimed and empowered by their sexualities. And they view their sexualizes through queer and feminist lenses rather than psychopathological ones. Dreger seems to buy this Baileyism that, like, trans women are prudes and they don't want to talk about it. And she ends up just focusing really super mainstream on this, like, in this really, like, heterocentric way, completely ignoring queer identified trans women. And not taking into account the fact that a lot of queer-identified trans women have a different view, I would say a more righteous, queer, or feminist view, rather than a psychopathological view of their own sexualities. If some trans women, I'll admit that some trans women are inclined to play down their sexualities, and there's a very good reason for this. So trans women are constantly sexualized in our culture. I discuss this in great detail in my book, Whipping Girl, and I also discuss it in an audio recording of a paper that I presented at the 2007 Association for Women in Psychology Conference. And the paper is called The Psychiatric Sexualization of MTF Transgenderism. There's a recording of it on my TS Etiology website. Webpage. And also, a lot of that work ended up being the chapter Transsexualization and Whipping Girl. So anyway, I would encourage you to read that or listen to that. I won't go into it in depth here. But suffice it to say that most people, whether psychologists or filmmakers or stand-up comics or sociologists or academics or everyday people, most people tend to compulsively sexualize trans women. And it's not just that our bodies are objectified, but our motives for transitioning are sexualized too. We're assumed to transition because we either want to prey on innocent straight men or to fulfill some kind of bizarre sex fantasy. And as I point out in my critique and in my book, basically those two stereotypes are the two stereotypes that are being pushed by Blanchard and Bailey. You know, those are the two stereotypes that they're forwarding. They already exist in the culture. The reason why people sexualize our motives is so that they don't have to take our female identity seriously. This is the same thing that happens when homophobes assume that gay people are looking for an alternative lifestyle, or that bisexuals are hypersexual and attracted to anything that moves. It's the same kind of delegitimization or projecting motives onto people. Furthermore, any feminist can tell you that non-consensual sexualization has the effect of devaluing and disempowering a person in their day-to-day lives. Some trans women react to this by desexualizing transsexuality and their transsexual experiences. Others of us embrace their sexuality in an attempt to wrestle it free from other people's presumptions. In other words, they try to reclaim it. But either way, it's a double-edged sword, because whether you embrace your sexuality or distance yourself from it, you're still going to be sexualized. And in fact, this is just another permutation of the same virgin whore double bind that women and feminists have been describing for a very long time, right? Blanchard's theory, and especially Bailey's take on it, reinforce the sexualization of trans women and our motives for transitioning. And for that reason, they provide ammo for those who wish to delegitimize our gender identities. Their work has been used by anti-trans religious organizations, by anti-trans feminists such as Sheila Jeffries, and it's also been used in sensationalistic and sexualizing mainstream articles on trans people. One example that comes to mind is a year or two ago, there was a Rolling Stone article about one of the Wachowski brothers who is supposedly, apparently, transitioned to female. And in it, they kind of bring in Bailey's theories and everything like that. And it's just this really sexualizing and sensationalistic piece. And it's enabled in part by these theories. I should mention that Dreger never talks about any of these examples of how this theory has been used to delegitimize trans people's identities. And it's this delegitimization of our identities and the sexualization that causes that. That's the main reason why trans people, and trans women in particular, feel threatened by these theories. At no point in our massive article does Dreger discuss the sexualization of trans women, how it's used as a tactic to delegitimize our female identities and lived experiences as women. This is one of the greatest failures of her article. And she totally dismisses how Bailey's book contributes to our sexualization and delegitimization. For example, on page 20, she euphemistically describes Bailey's thesis as a rejection of the feminine essence narrative. You know, like, what a euphemism. I would say that a more accurate depiction of what he actually does is to describe his thesis as the sexualization of trans women's motives. Because that's what he does. In fact, Dreger doesn't merely fail to take Bailey to task for his blatant sexualization of trans women, but she actually, she engages in quite a bit of it herself. So there are a couple things here that, like, a couple snippets I just want to mention. On pages 24 and 25, she goes into this thing where she replays this passage from Deirdre McCloskey's book that Bailey has read as her being an autogynephile. And she also, she shows snippets of this letter that Andrew James wrote to Anne Lawrence way back when James apparently at the time was like pro-autogynephilia. And she shows these things and she tries to kind of like weave them into her argument like they're kind of like relevant to her argument. But it just like feels like she's just showing that like, you know, obviously neither McCloskey nor James identify as an autogynephile. And she seems to be enabling their sexualization by bringing these passages up. There's really no reason for her to bring that up other than to sexualize them. And if you don't believe me on that, then I would say look at other examples of her sexualizing trans women throughout her article. So on page 9, she gives in this really graphic depiction of Kaltika's class presentation. She discusses like nude photos of Juanita on page 6, or the fact that she's a prostitute on page 28. These are all superfluous and gratuitous. They don't have anything to do with like the main points in the article. And she just like throws them out there. And when I was reading those passages, they reminded me of trial lawyers who try to bring up evidence that women are promiscuous during a trial, even though that information is tangential or unrelated to the main issue. There's a reason why they do that. They do it because in a sexist society, sexualizing people devalues and delegitimizes them. And it seems that Dreger, whether consciously or unconsciously, that she tried to tap into that. And those passages are likely to subliminally make the reader feel as though all these trans women had it coming to them, so to speak. Another annoying part of Dreger's article is when she argues that trans women judged Bailey's book by the cover before reading it. I mentioned this a bit in my commentary. But I want to talk about it even more here. So the insinuation here is that trans women's criticisms are invalid, that they're uninformed. And that's just stupid and insulting. What she doesn't mention is that transsexuals, especially those involved in activism, are extremely familiar with gatekeeper viewpoints and theories about us. And this has been documented by countless historians over the years. And in fact, if you actually read a lot of gatekeeper literature from the past, a lot of them actually bemoan the fact that trans people know a little bit too much about the theories about them, right? You know, that, like, we know what it is that they're looking for, what they're thinking, right? And they bemoan this fact. And so this is really well known. And so the idea that trans women are underinformed about the issue is ridiculous. You know, trans women are already familiar with Blanche's theory. It had been out there forever. Well, not forever, but it had been out there for quite a long time. It had been discussed and debated in trans female circles for years. And in fact, for years even before Bailey's book was published. And in 2000 and 2001, so this is a couple years before Bailey's book, Transgender Tapestry dedicated large chunks of 3 consecutive issues to discussing the matter. And in those issues, they offered all sorts of different commentaries, both pro and against, albeit mostly against. And, you know, so this thing had been discussed for a really long time before Bailey's book even came up. So the idea that, like, trans people judged the book by the cover and weren't paying attention to any of the information in it is, like, really dismissive. Furthermore, I also just want to point this out for later, that during those issues, the transgender tapestry issues, Andrew James, Lynn Conway nor Deirdre McCloskey wrote any of these commentaries. There was this whole discussion going on that they weren't, like, choreographing the whole thing. And I'm going to get back to this later because I feel like this is one of those things where she suggests that these three people, like, strong-armed the trans community into turning against Bailey. And, you know, all these opinions were already out there. This issue is being debated, etc., way before them. Okay. Here's another intersex analogy, because I kind of feel like that I don't know if she'll ever listen to this, but I think that this would be very useful for Alice Dreger to kind of think about things in this term. So I would say that dismissing trans women for being suspicious of Bailey's book before reading it would be kind of like dismissing intersex activists if John Money, may he rest in peace, or someone else who is involved in, like, you know, non-consensual surgeries on intersex infants, if one of them were to put out a book on how to raise intersex children. If you're already familiar with someone's past writings and comments, of course you're going to be suspicious of a book like that, right? With regards to the cover image itself, if a book subtitled The Science of Womanhood was published with a picture of a woman in a bikini on the cover, would feminists be forced to read the whole thing from cover to cover before being allowed to critique the presentation? If a sexologist put out a book on intersexuals called Not Quite Male, Not Quite Female, But a Little Bit of Both, The Science of Intersexuality, should intersex people be forced to read the whole entire book before being allowed to critique the title or the premise? No! When you're fully aware of and sensitive to the tropes that are consistently used to marginalize you as a minority group, you have every right to critique them and to call people out on them when they happen. Another Baileyism that Dreger affords is the idea that the concept of autogynephilia resonates with some trans women, and so therefore it can't possibly be transphobic or sexist. I would say this is another example of fifth grader logic again. Here's an analogy. Some women believe that only men should be in charge because God decreed that that should be the case. Does that make men who insist that women shouldn't be allowed to take on any leadership positions any less sexist? Some gay people really do feel that homosexuality is a disease that they're inflicted with. Does that make people who argue that gay people are sick, disturbed, and mentally ill, or mentally disordered any less homophobic? No! The thing is that just because you can find a few examples of people who kind of agree with, you know, pathologizing or belittling views about them, just because you can find some people who agree with that doesn't mean that the theory itself isn't bad or dismissive or marginalizing. As someone who's extremely active in trans circles, and I'm going to say this right here, and this might make some people pissed off, but this has been my experience. As someone who's been extremely active in trans circles, I found that autogynephilic-identified trans women represent a very small minority. And frankly, more often than not, they tend to be underinformed and rather apolitical when it comes to trans history and politics. And in fact, I have found that many of them eventually change their minds from a pro-autogynephilia to an anti-autogynephilia perspective as they become more involved and informed about trans politics. And this isn't because they're brainwashed into, like, you know, towing the line. It's because as someone becomes involved in trans politics, they become really aware of and cognizant of the fact that the biggest obstacle, or one of the biggest obstacles that we as a community face, is the fact that transsexuality is pathologized and seen as a mental disorder. And autogynephilia is as pathologizing as it gets. It's not merely a mental disorder, like GID is, but it's conceptualized as a paraphilia, a category that includes pedophilia, as well as other less disturbing, albeit still highly stigmatized, expressions of sexuality. I would say, the further talk about this for a second, I mentioned before that Dreger kind of shows snippets of this letter that Andrew James wrote before when she was supposedly or apparently pro-autogynephilia. And she kind of does that and kind of the idea is that she's kind of being hypocritical because she really did believe it, or she really was an Autogana fan or whatever. And but I would say that, not knowing Andrew James, I would say that she probably had the same trajectory that a lot of trans people I know have had, of kind of having the theory resonate with them at first, and then as they become more involved in activism, seeing actually how problematic it is and changing their mind. I would also say that the fact that this is another kind of Baileyism here, where Bailey and others have tried to say that, like, oh, well, there's lots of women who agree with the theory. And she kind of buys into this pretty uncritically, I think. And I think the thing is, if you're Bailey, trans women who are pro-autogynephilia will probably come to you, right? And so he's seeing this really biased sample size of, you know, him and Anne Lawrence, and those people are seeing all the people who are pro-autogynephilia who are talking to them, right? But if you're actually in the trans community itself, like the actual trans community, if you're not getting this biased selection of people who are coming to you, then you probably get a better idea of actually what the community is like. And again, like I said, from my perspectives, and my experiences, it's been a very small minority, and I'm going to get back to that in a second. Let's see, I kind of got lost here. I also wanted to bring this up with regards to, I kind of got off course here, but in addition to the fact that, Blanchard's theory being really pathologizing, another reason why people get involved in trans activism are often against it is because it forces all trans women into one of two rigid categories. So in other words, it's extremely binary. And trans people, having already been marginalized by male-female gender binary that fails to accommodate the complexities and diversities of people's genders, trans people view this whole all trans women are either homosexual or autogynephilic thing as a joke. They see it as another binary that cannot contain us, that doesn't accurately describe us. They see it as another binary that oppresses us. And so this is another reason why trans women, once they get involved in trans activism, also often see Blanchard's theory as being really problematic and simple-minded. As many trans women have previously argued, the reason why a lot of trans women are drawn towards autogynephilia theory, especially when they first find out about it, is because the gatekeeper system has required trans women to deny or repress or keep secret our sexual urges and experiences in order to be allowed to transition. This has been set in place since, like, you know, the Harry Benjamin days. And the concept of autogynephilia offers newly transitioning trans women, especially those who are lesbian and bisexual identified, to embrace their sexualities for the first time in their lives. However, once they've been post-transitioned for a couple years, two things generally happen that tend to make them change their views. So one of them, I would say three things, right? So one of them I already mentioned, that they sometimes become more involved in activism. A second thing is that most trans women, after transitioning, lose interest in those fantasies. And so this has been documented by Anne Lawrence, in fact. And also from conversations with lots of trans people, this seems to be just a general case. The fact that they lose interest in those fantasies leads them to recognize that the fantasies weren't the cause of them being transsexual. That's not why they transitioned. But rather, they understand at that point that those fantasies were a coping mechanism, a way of dealing with and making sense of one's transsexuality prior to transitioning. Most trans women that I know who have had what I would call sex embodiment fantasies, or what Bailey would call autogynephilic fantasies, most trans women I know who have had them, have experienced them, see those as a coping mechanism of some sort. So it's really bizarre that Dreger never even bothers mentioning this in her article. And I can only think of two reasons for this. One is that she doesn't want to undermine the theory. Or two, and probably a more realistic one, is that that she just didn't really she basically didn't listen to trans women enough, or didn't talk to enough trans women, or gain their trust enough that ever came up. Anyway, The third thing that happens to trans women that often makes them change their mind about autogynephilia is that once newly transitioned trans women began living in the world as women and as trans women, they for the first time in their lives experienced being sexualized in those ways. And therefore, they begin to understand how sexualization is often used to marginalize them, both as women and as trans women. And I find that the trans women who are most upset by Blanchard's theory are those who are sick and tired of being non-consensually sexualized, and they see this theory as exacerbating that. From their personal experiences, they realize that the concept of autogynephilia not only sexualizes and delegitimizes their identities, but it has the potential to jeopardize trans people's access to sex reassignment and our social and legal status as women. And this is another thing that's kind of poo-pooed in the paper, but the truth is that, and by poo-pooed I mean that Dreger kind of like plays, you know, Bailey's book and the theory as not actually endangering trans women in any way. But everyone knows that many doctors, if not most doctors, would be extremely uncomfortable with offering trans people hormones and surgeries if it was seen as merely satisfying some kind of fetish or perversion. So anyway, this whole some women support the theory tactic is a red herring, given the fact that those trans women who do support it tend to be least involved in or are new to or unconcerned by trans politics and history. Let's see, I did something bad. I'm kind of following my notes here, and oh, there it is. Okay. So sorry about that. Yeah, period. Okay, there's a reason why pro-autogynephilic sexologists always point toward Anne Lawrence and her support of Blanchard's theory. She is, to my knowledge, the only trans woman out there who has made a name for herself as a trans activist and who also supports Blanchard's theory. I challenge you to give me the name of any other well-known trans activist who is also a supporter of Bailey's theory. There aren't any. I haven't heard of any, right? And I'm really, really plugged into the community. Regarding Anne Lawrence, let me take a sip first. Okay, regarding Anne Lawrence, one of the ways that Dreger tries to show how thoughtless and evil the trans women anti-autogynephilic communities are is by portraying Anne Lawrence as someone who's been unfairly demonized and made a pariah in her own trans community because of her support for Blanchard's theory. So I should point out at this point that Camille Paglia might be considered a pariah in the feminist community, and that Clarence Thomas might be considered a pariah in African-American communities. The reason for this is not because these communities are thoughtless or mean-spirited or evil or under-informed, but because those individuals have forwarded theories and politics that most people in those communities feel undermines their cause. While I've certainly heard a number of what I would consider unfair and even downright mean comments made about Lawrence over the years, I've also heard a lot of justified ones. And I think it's important to make this distinction here because it illuminates what I feel is a major flaw of reasoning in Dreger's paper. So if autogynephilia was just an identity, and some trans women went around saying, I considered myself an autogynephile, well, I'm sure that some trans people might have an issue with that. I believe that the majority wouldn't. And I think that most trans people have a really deep respect for other people's right to self-identify. The main reason why Lawrence is demonized is not because she identifies as autogynephilic, but because she supports a theory that non-consensually labels other trans women as autogynephilic. In other words, the problem isn't autogynephilia per se, but gender entitlement. That is, when one privileges their own perceptions, interpretations, and evaluations of other people's genders over the way those people understand themselves. Dreger is completely oblivious to this distinction. On page 25, she says, quote, the backlash against the man who would be queen became something of a purge where autogynephilia was concerned, end quote. That so misses the point. In my experience, what pisses trans women off most about this issue isn't autogynephilia as an abstract concept or the fact that the claim that some people have autogynephilic fantasies. I think that most trans women will acknowledge the fact that those fantasies are out there. They wouldn't necessarily call them autogynephilic or assume that they cause transsexuality, but most people will accept the fact that those fantasies exist. What really pisses trans women off is being arrogantly and non-consensually labeled as autogynephiles by others. Dreger doesn't get this at all. Or maybe she just chooses not to see it. Perhaps this is why she doesn't get why trans women are so outraged by Bailey's book. Simply put, Bailey's book is the single most gender-entitled book written by a sexologist on the subject of transsexuality that I've ever read. I've read a lot of them. He not only non-consensually labels trans women as either homosexuals or autogynephiles, but he insists that any trans woman whose self-accounts differ from those stereotypes must be lying. If you read his Men Trapped in Men's Bodies chapter, you'll see he uses words like deceiving and misleading over and over again to describe trans women who don't identify as autogynephilic or who describe life experiences that contradict this stereotype. So, I figured what I'd do here is just read a couple sentences from that chapter that highlight this. So, this is just to give you a taste of it. Autogynephiles have claimed that they choose stereotypically masculine occupations to hide their feminine side, but I doubt this. Some autogynephiles claim that they have early memories of their condition, such as the desire to be female. I have tended to be skeptical about these memories. Most gender patients lie, says Maxine Peterson, the ace gender clinician at the Clark. One common lie among autogynephiles, according to Peterson, is that they are homosexual rather than heterosexual. Other common lies, according to Peterson and other, include an exaggeration of early femininity. The most common way that autogynephiles mislead others is by denying the erotic component of their gender bending. And then later that same paragraph, there's a crossdresser who talks about, who says, I wear feminine clothing because I feel feminine, and I can't help but getting aroused because the clothes are sexy. Any man would. And Bailey replies, I don't think so. Why do some autogynephiles deny the sexual component of their condition? There's one more reason why autogynephiles provide misleading information about themselves that's different from outright lying. It has to do with obsession. The self-presentational deceptiveness of some autogynephiles is the main reason why autogynephilia was not understood until recently. So anyway, so that's just like a little taste of that. And if you're not a trans woman, all of us have issues for which we're marginalized or that are obstacles in our lives. And imagine that someone who's deemed to be an expert on you, on whatever you are, basically said something that totally went against the way you see yourself and your personal experiences and essentially accused you of lying or deceiving others when you talk the truth about your own life. And imagine how that feels, how that would feel, how dismissive and undermining and that would feel, and how frustrating and angry and annoyed you would be. And that's what pissed trans women off so much about the book. Okay. And again, I think it's really important to view this. It's not just that he said all this stuff, right? He has freedom of speech. But the fact that he's a gatekeeper, that he's viewed as an expert on transsexuality, that his words trump our words in the domain, the discourses about transsexuality that exists. And because of that reason, that's why he not only like erases our life experiences, but his work constitutes a political threat to our existence. One other little side note that I wanted to point out, because Madeline Winsden brings this up on her website, is, you know, because Bailey, like, talks about trans women lying and misleading, and the other ridiculous part about this, and this also doesn't really appear in Dreger's article, Not surprisingly, but the thing is that Blanchard's model is entirely based on trans people's self-reporting, like his interpretation on trans people's self-reportings. So Bailey is essentially arguing for that model by dismissing self-accounts of trans people. So those people who don't fit the model are considered liars. So in other words, he just like handpicks what evidence counts and what doesn't. I've seen a couple writers dismiss the analogy that some trans women have made between Bailey's book and Janice Raymond's classic anti-trans diatribe, The Transsexual Empire. While I'd have to agree that Bailey's book isn't nearly as hateful and vitriolic as Raymond's, it is just as gender-entitled, in that it forecloses transsexual self-identities and experiences. Further, I think that it's fair to say that Bailey's book is more of a threat to trans women's existence than Raymond's book ever was. While the average person has never heard of Janice Raymond and couldn't care less what a lesbian feminist academic has to say about transsexuals, people are very interested in what psychological experts have to say about us. Again, their opinions are solicited about us all the time in documentaries and on news programs. Bailey may be a nice guy, a family man, etc., but his book erases trans women. And that's why so many of us were pissed off about his book, and that's why Drager's failure to recognize Bailey's gender entitlement as a primary cause of trans women's anger makes her article sound apologist on his behalf. Okay, so that's the end of the first monster section. I promise you the next two sections are extremely shorter than that. So I want to go into now parts where she's flat out wrong. So this is beyond spin, this is flat out wrong. Okay, so this is on page 38. I'm going to read a quote from her article. I think it's fair to say, given the historical evidence noted above, that the firestorm against the man who would be queen was initially motivated by a few powerful transsexual women's strong public rejection of Blanchard's theory. Powerful transsexual women. Okay, I'd have to say that that's honestly... That whole passage right there is bullshit. Trans people are completely capable of developing our own opinions, thank you. The idea that we take orders from a couple powerful transsexual women is really insulting. Not only is it insulting, but it's, like, stupid. Because anyone who's ever been on a trans email list or been part of a trans conference or discussion group will know that trans women and transsexuals in general don't obediently all march to the same tune. We have lots and lots of disagreements and arguments over theory and politics and take different positions on lots of different issues. And in fact, trans women, we've been through a lot, far more than Drager ever has, and it makes us very tenacious and sometimes even stubborn. And I find that trans women are constantly arguing about the specifics of trans issues, theory, and politics. And in fact, I would say that among trans women who are 2 years or more post-transition, or who are involved in trans activism, the perspective that Blanchard's theory is problematic, if not outright false, is one of the few opinions that people generally agree upon. You know, people disagree on almost everything else except this, I find. Drager paints a picture where powerful transsexual women, specifically CJM, Conway James McCloskey, sent out marching orders to the rest of the trans community, and everyone else obediently followed. That's silly and insulting. The trans community isn't monolithic or hierarchical in any sense. If you ask any activist, they'll tell you that the trans community is actually very diverse and very diffuse. Just to give you, like, a little bit of insight into how off-base Drager's fantasy of a few powerful transsexual women commanding the entire trans community to turn against Bailey, here's my own personal timeline regarding learning about Blanchard's theory and Bailey's book. So, I first learned about Blanchard's theory through Anne Lawrence's website. So when I was first transitioning, I found her site useful. That's actually where I discovered writers like Susan Stryker and Jessica Xavier and everything there. So for that, I was grateful. I also found there her now classic Men Trapped in Men's Bodies essay, which is the essay that For most people in the trans community, at least back then, introduced them to the subject of autogynephilia and Blanchard's theory. My initial reaction after reading it was that it was really, really oversimplistic and didn't make sense. So I knew that I wanted to be female before I ever had those kind of fantasies, what I would call sex embodiment fantasies. And I already viewed these fantasies as related to the shame I felt about wanting to be female and trying to make sense of that in a culture where femaleness and femininity are regularly sexualized. And somehow, by powers unbeknownst to me, I was able to come up with my own skeptical opinion about Blanchard's theory without the help of Lynn Conway, Andrew James, or Deirdre McCloskey. Pat on the back for me. And then I read that, and then after that, I would notice the issue would sometimes pop up on email lists. So I found that if I was on at the time two different types of lists. I was still on a bunch of like newbie transitioning lists for like people first starting out. And the subject would come up there and it would often be debated. On email lists that I were on that were either activist-centric or that were more queer or feminist-centric trans lists, I never once in my whole life have ever seen a pro-autogynephilia post ever on any of those things. And the reason is because, again, the theory is very pathologizing and sexualizing, and has built into it are these ideas about maleness and femaleness and heterosexuality and homosexuality that most people who are, you know, queer theorists or feminist influenced people just see as being really utterly ridiculous. So anyway, I should also mention that CJM never once, ever to my knowledge, ever posted on any of those lists that I was on. Neither did Joan Roughgarden or Becky Allison or anyone else who Dregger might consider to be a powerful transsexual woman. This is just people. This is just trans women having these conversations amongst themselves, right? Without being directed by any of the powerful transsexual women, right? And then, I guess, probably around 2003 when Bailey's book came out, somewhere around then, on one of my lists, someone put up a link to Bailey's book. So it was online, and you could read the preface there. And so I read it. At the time, I didn't know who Bailey was, and I read it, and I was really appalled by it. And so I'm going to read you a short passage from that preface to just give you an idea of why I was appalled by it. Okay. So this is a passage about someone named Edwin, who is a feminine man who works as a cosmetic salesperson in a department store. And so this is what Bailey says. Knowing his occupation and observing him briefly and superficially were sufficient together for me to guess confidently about aspects of Edwin's life that he never mentioned. I know what he was like as a boy. I know what kind of person he is sexually attracted to. I know what kinds of activities interest him and what kinds do not. I am least sure what he will look like 5 years from now. Based upon his current appearance, there's a chance he will undergo a dramatic change. And then anyway, so you can see what I was talking about before, the gender entitlement in that is like completely off the hook. I mean, it's just like ridiculous. You know, here are a couple more things from the same preface. I already know that Edwin played with dolls and loathed football. Although I didn't ask him, I know Edwin likes to have sex with men. And you know, it's just like ridiculous. It's really arrogant. Anyone who's queer, or just anyone who's a reasonable person, knows it's just really horrible and ridiculous and everything to just assume, make these gross assumptions about people without, like, taking any input from them. It's so arrogant. Okay, so anyway, so I read that and immediately, forgive me, but I assumed from just reading that passage that the book was a joke and was not an actual joke, but I just thought it was ridiculous and so misguided. And so yeah, so I basically had that impression, and it was the right impression, and I later have read the book. Sadly, I've read it twice now. as someone who's who Bailey would consider consider an autogynephile, and therefore who has a paraphilia, perhaps that's a sign that I'm also masochistic, that I read his book twice. Anyway, where was I? So I read that, right? And then after that, the book kept coming up. Issues about the book kept coming up on different lists I was on, and I would read, like, little snippets of stuff that was going on. For example, I heard about the protests, and this is also as a scientist, I heard about the protests from, like, people like June Roughgarden and Ben Barrs, and Lynn Conway's name is also on that list, although I was unaware of the fact that she was choreographing the whole thing, like, behind the curtain, right, at the time. But anyway, so I heard about their protests at the National Academies for the fact that the book was actually being pushed as a science book. And then the next thing is, like, this real big beef that I have with her article, because she kind of paints this portrait that, you know, it was Lynn Conway and Deirdre McCloskey were the ones who kind of created the whole idea of this petition against the Lambda Literary Award nomination that Bailey's book received. And again, this is another situation where I feel like Dreger's take on this whole issue is extremely heterocentric. Like, ridiculously heterocentric. It's so awful. Because it's just, like, looking at it, like, from the outside of the queer community, like, looking in, like, oh, you know, like, Lynn Conway, Deirdre McCloskey did this petition. I'm in the queer community, and I'm on lots of lists, and when that thing happened, those petitions were flying around, and everyone wanted to sign them, okay? And to give you an idea of kind of what this issue is about from a queer perspective, not a heterocentric perspective that she tries to push in her article, I encourage you to listen to Gender Talk Program 450, which was done on March 1st, 2004. GenderTalk.com has all archives of the show, so you can listen to it there. And on that episode was, the guests were Kate Bornstein and Gal Leandar Wright. And they were talking about the ongoing controversy regarding the nomination of Bailey's book for the Lambda Literary Awards. And the way that they frame this is completely different from the way Dreger depicts it, and it totally meshes with how I saw it and how a lot of other queer people, queer trans people I know, saw the issue, which is, it wasn't about, like, you know, it was more, from our perspective, about Lambda, LGBT organization, where LGBT organizations often have, like, the little t on the end of the acronym, and a lot of the people involved in the organization are not really clued into or tuned into basically trans people's concerns and issues, and are sometimes clueless. And the idea from a queer perspective that this book would be nominated was really appalling to a lot of not just trans people, but trans allies. And if you listen to that conversation that they have, that's what they're talking about. And I also encourage you to listen to that. If you in any way think that you even somewhat buy Dreger's take on this whole issue, I encourage you to listen to it, because it shows you the diversity of opinions, and you know, you get to hear Nancy Nangiarone, who was particularly pissed off about how arrogant Bailey was, and how she didn't use the words gender entitled, but I would say how gender entitled his book was. And she read from the passage that I just read about, the Edwin passage, right? And then Gurdine McKenzie, she read, she was really upset and talked for a bit about how Bailey eroticized and objectified trans women of color in the book. And so she read this passage, and I think that this passage is about as good of an example of his book being really sexualizing as it gets, particularly in kind of like a racialized sexualization. I start upstairs to get the panoramic view, and I see Kim for the first time, on the stairs, dancing, posing. She is spectacular, exotic. I find out later she's from Belize, and sexy. Her body is incredibly curvaceous, which is a clue that it might not be natural. And I notice a very subtle and not unattractive angularity of the face, which is also not clearly diagnostic on this tall siren. It is difficult to avoid viewing Kim from two perspectives, as a researcher, but also as a single heterosexual man. As I contemplate approaching her, I am influenced by considerations from each perspective. I have this strong intuition that I am correct about her, but if I am not, I might have the unpleasant experience of simultaneously insulting and being rejected by a beautiful woman. So that passage is really over the top. I'm really sexualizing. And in fact, a lot of the most sexualizing passages in the book are directed at trans women of color. And so Gradeen McKenzie brings this up. And then, like, Kate Bornstein talks about binaryism, how, like, you know, it's these two rigid categories and how sexualizing and pathologizing the book is. And then Gail Leander Wright talks about the troubled history of Lambda and trans issues. And actually, she was played a role early on in getting a transgender category on there. And she was talking about how Lambda is never quite, at least up to that point, gotten their act together to really make themselves knowledgeable and in tune with trans people, right? And our issues. And in that whole book, episode, you know, there's this one really brief fleeting moment where Lynn Conway is mentioned as having been previously on a show and having talked about the issue before, right? But, like, other than that, I'm sorry, Alice Stryker, but there's no way that you can convince me that Lynn Conway and Andrea James and Deirdre McCloskey are somehow, like, that they control Nancy Nangeroni and that, you know, that Kate Bornstein and Gradeen McKenzie and all of these other people, like, march to what Lynn Conway says, you know? You know, does Ben Barrs and Joan Roughgarden and Madeline Winsden, do they all take orders from CJM? I mean, of course not. It's ridiculous. It's insulting. You know, it's insulting. And you see this go on in other situations where someone, like, you know, kind of dismisses the leaders of some community, and the assumption is always, like, that the community members are too stupid to think for themselves and that the leader just controls them like puppets. It's like, no, we can think for ourselves. And to be honest, that was, like, one of the most insulting things about her article. To be honest, personally, I only found out that Lynn Conway and Andrea James were, like, really heavily invested in, you know, like, basically following this issue and critiquing it and posting a lot about it. I only found out about that around 2005 when I started doing preliminary research for my book Whipping Girl. And that's not any offense to their site. Their sites are, like, I visited them a lot when I was first transitioning back in, like, the early 2000s, and they're really awesome. They have a lot of great material there for newbies and everything, but I just hadn't visited their sites in a while. And it wasn't until I started actually actively doing research on kind of Bailey and Blanchard for my book that I saw that there was just, they have, you know, just, like, massive, material about the controversy there. And so the idea that, you know, that CJM single-handedly choreographed the whole thing, like, from behind, like, some Wizard of Oz curtain. Again, it's just, it's ridiculous. And then, so she makes a lot of allegations in her article. There are only two of them that seem to have some obvious truth to them that I'll say that, you know, yeah, that looks like that happened. So the first is Andrea James' satire that she did. And let me just read this. This is what Alice Stryker said about it. So this is page 37 of her article. She says, in May 2003, James created a special portion of her site to go after Bailey's children. In her own words, this page was a quote, a very coarse and mean-spirited screed designed to reflect what I consider Bailey's own motivations to be a taste of his own medicine, end quote. For this project, James took from Bailey's homepage photos of his son Drew and daughter Kate when they were in junior high and primary school, respectively. She then superimposed black bands over their eyes, presumably to mimic the dehumanizing pictures of trans people in the medical literature. Under the picture of Drew, using mostly a line from Bailey's book about trans women, she added the caption, quote, "There are also kids like Drew who work as waiters, hairdressers, receptionists, strippers, and prostitutes, as well as in many other occupations," end quote. Meanwhile, James labeled Kate's picture this way, quote, "Kate, a cock-starved exhibitionist or paraphilic, who just gets off on the idea of it. We'll find out in 12 easy questions," end quote. In an update on this page, James delighted, quote, "that professionals are reading this page and acting with disgust," end quote. Okay, so that's what Alice Dreger had to say about it. And so one thing that kind of jumps out at me that I want to say before I go on is that she makes this real assumption. Her choice of words here is very interesting. So Alice Dreger says, James delighted, quote, and then what James actually said. And, you know, that just seems really, really twisted to me that like, Alice Dreger is assuming that Andrew James is delighting in this, you know? And to be honest, you know, you know, I don't know how Andrew James felt, but she sounds really angry to me. And I understand where that anger comes from, and I feel very angry about it too, and I understand what it's like to write or to create a critique out of anger. I don't think that the idea that she delighted is just so, like, morbid and everything, and it's just, like, that's what Alice Dreger thinks of her. I just think is, like, really twisted and dismissive. Anyway, so that's what Dreger had to say. This is what Deirdre McCloskey said in a Bay Area Reporter article about that satire. Quote, "Dr. Dreger makes a great deal of Andrew James' satire in Bailey's Views, which Ms. James hastily withdrew when many of us complained about its bad taste. Satire is a legitimate and ancient device in political disputes, which is what this is. Even satire and bad taste has long been accepted as fair comment on people who enter, of their own accord, the public arena." End quote. So, having put that info out, this is kind of what I think that really strikes me about this, is that, like, you know, I would say that, I don't think that the satire was a smart idea, but I think it mostly, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, it was his children who, A, were not, you know, involved in the matter, right? You know, they didn't have anything to do with it. So it's wrong that they got brought into it. But the fact that it really resonated with a lot of people, that a lot of people really bothered by it, also has to do with the fact that people can identify with Bailey being a father, right? Like, non-trans people, they can identify with that. Similarly, when Alice Dreger makes these accusations that, that Andrew James, like, threatened her, like, that in a way that kind of related to her being a mother or her children or something. I forget exactly what that was. But, like, that's another thing. Like, the idea of, like, people can really identify with that. The thing that people don't identify with is they don't identify with transsexuals. They don't identify with trans women. And, you know, people don't care what people say about trans women, which is part of the reason why, like, a lot of the things Bailey says in his book, a lot of trans activists and trans allies and advocates were really, really bothered by the book, but nobody else cares, right? And that really, that whole incident really strikes me as how nobody just really even cares about trans women, and those horrible things that were said about his children that were just so awful, if you say them about a trans woman, nobody really cares. So anyway, so I would agree with Deirdre McCloskey that I don't think it was necessarily the smartest satire, but it was a satire, and there is a real point there underneath it all. The second thing that I would say that seems to be true is the fact that Lynn Conway interacted with a couple of the subjects of Bailey's book, right? Kyle Tika and Juanita and encourage them to come forward. And the way that this is portrayed by Dreger is that, you know, all these people were happy and liked Bailey and everything was honky-dory, and then all of a sudden Lynn Conway came around and all of a sudden they were, like, you know, filing these accusations. And kind of the implication through it all is that Lynn Conway, again, using her, you know, powerful transsexual powers, you know, you know, using her, like, mind control powers, that she was able to all of a sudden get them to do things that either weren't true or that they didn't want to do, but she somehow coerced them or whatever. And that seems really twisted to me, too. Frankly, I don't think that there's anything wrong that she talked to them, and if they came forward after that, that doesn't necessarily mean that there's any foul play involved. Here's an example. A friend of mine once brought up the fact to me that in their job, they were kind of, like, harassed related to them being trans, and they were really bothered by it, but they didn't say anything to their bosses or anything. And in talking to them, I'm like, you should say something, you know, you can't just let this happen or it'll just happen again and everything. And then they ended up, you know, confronting their boss about it after the fact. Now, did I coerce them into doing it? Did I brainwash them into doing it? No, it's just that they had a lot of ambivalent feelings about it, and I talked to them, and my opinion convinced them. I wasn't trying to change their mind, per se, but hearing a second opinion made them want to come forward. And I don't, and to me, it seems like that's probably what happened here, because after all, to the best of my knowledge, Lynn Conway doesn't have special hypnotic powers, right? Or maybe she does, and maybe she's controlling me right now, and she's controlling, you know, her whole transsexual minions and everything, right? Again, you know, Kaltik and Juanita are adults, and it's just, like, this whole thing, of it's just insulting not only to, like, CJM, but it's insulting to the rest of the trans community to think that, like, we don't think for ourselves. She goes on and on for pages, Dreger again, goes on and on for pages about how CJM did this or that, but a lot of it's just speculation, and a lot of it's based solely on Kaltika's testimony, which is kind of weird given that on page 20, Dreger paints Kaltika as an unreliable witness when she says something about Bailey fabricating a big chunk of the book, right? The whole Danny story. And so she doesn't trust Kaltika in that respect, but she seems to a lot of times make accusations about Lynn Conway and others solely based on Kaltika's comments, right? So it's kind of like Bailey, she handpicks her evidence. So maybe Lynn Conway, Andrew James, and Deirdre McCloskey tried to ruin Bailey. Maybe they crossed the line, right? Like, pretend that happened, right? Even if that did happen, frankly, Dreger's heavy-handed, biased approach makes me not want to give her the benefit of the doubt about this, you know? In fact, if I didn't know anything about the controversy, I would be really suspicious of an investigation where she doesn't bother interviewing one of the main people she makes accusations about, and the other central figure wouldn't even return her calls, you know? And yet Dreger at the same time says, "No sexologists refused my questions." Gee, I wonder why. Maybe sexologists are nice, innocent, good people, and Lynn Conway and Andrew James have something to hide. Or maybe it was Dreger's 2006 blog, where she compared Andrew James to neo-Nazis and was sympathetic with Bailey and how he was a poor guy who was attacked. And that was all before she even began working on this thing. So speaking of comparing people to Nazis... Why is it that, like, every, like, any kind of controversy that happens, it always ends up with someone calling someone a Nazi, right? Anyway, speaking of comparing people to Nazis, I want to end this section with a little bit of history, especially since we find so little of it in Alice Dreger's article. as I mentioned in my peer commentary, It is impossible to understand the Baylor controversy unless you place it in the context of the long history of trans activists trying to challenge the psychiatric pathologization of transsexuality and our attempts to redefine ourselves in non-pathological ways, for example, as transgender or as gender variant. Therefore, I'd suggest that the most apt comparison to the Bailey backlash, if we really want to understand it, is the gay rights movement protests against the psychiatric pathologization of homosexuality. So, in the early 1970s, activists, homosexual activists, disrupted several American Psychology Association conferences. They're the ones who are publishers of the DSM. And they reportedly ridiculed and shouted down psychiatrists who believed that homosexuality was a mental disorder. During the uproar at the 1971 conference, gay activist Frank Kameny grabbed the microphone and yelled, this is a great quote, he yelled, quote, "Psychiatry is the enemy incarnate. Psychiatry has waged a relentless war of extermination against us. You may take this as a declaration of war against you." End quote. Not surprisingly, many psychiatrists who attended that meeting apparently compared such tactics to those of Nazi stormtroopers. So, let me ask you this. Did the gay rights activists have to stoop to shouting at and ridiculing psychiatrists? Couldn't Frank Kameny have toned down his rhetoric a bit? You know, been a little more polite? In theory, yes, but that completely misses the point. From an outsider's perspective, it might seem like this was a whole over-the-top, beyond-the-pale reaction by gay activists. It might seem completely disproportionate of a reaction, right? But from the activist's perspective, it probably seemed like an appropriately strong response, given the fact that they were confronting the community that held institutional power over them and which contributed to their marginalization. And the fact that psychiatrists compared these gay activists to Nazis show how oblivious they were to their own institutionalized power that they held over that group. In other words, you know, they saw the gay activists, the minority group who was protesting their oppression, they saw the minority group as being the Nazis, right? And this is completely reminiscent how Dreger compares, like, James to, like, neo-Nazis for, like, her reaction and things that she said and stuff related to Bailey, right? Often people who have institutionalized power over others fail to see or acknowledge who is really the oppressed minority in these matters. Bailey can try all he wants to frame himself as a victim of academic McCarthyism, but he's not the oppressed minority in this story. Transsexuals are. And the reason why Alice Dreger's scholarly history, so-called scholarly history, is so myopic is because she, like Bailey, fails to recognize this point. Okay, so we're on to the third and last and very shortest section, where I talk about Alice Dreger's hypocrisy. And this is, I just want to just point out a couple small things here. Early on, she, like, talks about how a lot of the trans activists portrayed this in oversimplistic good versus evil terms, and yet she does the exact same thing. She over and over again, you know, kind of paints Bailey out as this nice guy, albeit he's a little politically incorrect, but she makes him seem like an interesting dinner guest, you know? Like, he's not someone who marginalizes or oppresses people. He's just, he's the kind of guy who rubs you the wrong way sometimes, but he's an interesting dinner guest. And on the other hand, she totally plays the trans activists, a lot of them out, as complete monsters. She plays into this whole idea that trans people are monsters, the whole psycho dress to kill thing, which is really, you know, even more significant or symbolic here, because part of the reason why trans people are portrayed as monsters is because, like, we're mentally disordered, right? You know, like, the whole psycho, even the name psycho, right? Silence of the Lambs and Just to Kill thing, it's all about trans people are psychotic monsters, right? And the fact that she kind of portrays trans women who are reacting to their pathologization as monsters has kind of a weird, sad irony to it. And, you know, the thing is that she really focuses only on the most unsavory things. If she was doing a real history, an actual history, she would focus on the whole entire breadth of the trans community's reaction. She could focus, instead of on all that stuff, she could focus on things that Madeline Winston has said or what other people have said. You know, there are a lot of people, trans activists who wrote about this issue and everything, who weren't in a position of, like, crossing a line where they're just critiquing it, and their voices are invisibilized in this. And by comparison, or basically because she only focuses on the most unsavory aspects, it kind of distorts the whole thing into this, it paints the picture that trans people, the whole trans reaction, the trans community entire reaction was, like, a hysterical overreaction. Another hypocrisy is that on page 21, she makes this comment about how, about BBL, which is what some people refer to Blanchard Bailey and Lawrence theory, I guess is what it is, but BBL, and she makes this, like, kind of catty remark, like, which were lumped together by Lynn Conway and Andrew James as a single uniformly dangerous beast, right? And yet, you know, so she does that, but then her whole article is, like, about CJM. Like, that's why I use that in my critique, because she does the same thing. It's not about the whole entire trans community. It's about Lynn Conway, Andrew James, and Deirdre McCloskey. And, like, Deirdre McCloskey, I mean, she hardly did anything. It's just kind of like, in order to have an access of evil, you have to have three. And so, like, Andrew James, like, picked the third person out of a hat, you know? anyway. So that's why I use CJM in my thing. I thought it was a nice little inside joke. She accuses Lynn Conway and Andrew James of doing an internet smear campaign. And yet, in May 2003, she raked Andrew James through the mud on her blog I Write in Fear. And she wrote a lot of that stuff before she even had a supposed interaction with Andrew James, right? Like, you know, so, you know, speaking of internet smear campaigns, right? She also complains about, you know, like, trans activists' harsh rhetoric, like, time and time again. And yet then, on KQED, they recently had this program where her and Bailey were on, and she was kind of, like, defending his book and talking about her article, and there were people on the other side, too, Joan Ruff Garden, and I forget who the other person was. But, anyway, in it, a caller calls in thinking that, they had Bailey's website, but it was actually Madeline Winston's website, and Alice Dreger actually said, oh, you know, that's not Bailey's website, that's his enemy, that, you know, and that really struck me, right, because Madeline Winston, if there's, like, anyone who's been so totally above the fray about this whole thing, it's been Madeline Winston. I think that her writings about the issue, while they're definitely anti-Blanchard theory and anti-Bailey's book, she's very respectful in it. There's no smearing going on. She even has links to both sides of the debate on her thing. And the idea that, like, she would be considered an enemy just shows you how, like, harsh Dreger's rhetoric is on this issue and how, like, she often is depicting this in good versus evil terms. Another thing is, Alice Dreger complains about this whole thing about, like, Lynn Conway trying to manipulate the press against Bailey, right? And yet, you know, and yet, you know, as soon as her preprint was out there, all of a sudden the New York Times is doing a piece about her article and KQED is and everything. And, you know, I know how things work. And, like, you just don't get a New York Times piece when something happens. Like, people send out press releases, right? Somebody sent out a press release or made some phone calls to the New York Times and KQED, right? Somebody actively did that. And I don't know whether it was Dreger or Bailey or someone else, but frankly, you know, there was definitely, I'm not going to say manipulating the press, but they definitely, someone on that side was trying to get press attention for it. And how is that any different from, you know, from what she claims that trans activists did trying to get bad press about Bailey's book, right? So, like, The thing is that, like, in reading her article, I just kept thinking, like, what's the difference? Like, what's the difference between what she accuses Lynn Conway and Andrea James of and what she does herself, you know? The only difference is really that is that she can hide behind kind of the shroud of academia and the ivory tower. So what she says is objective and everything. But, like, you know. And so here's another thing, you know, that, like, she tries to portray herself as being really objective and everything, but, you know, if she really wanted to be objective, so shortly after the preprint came out, there was, she was a guest editor of Perspectives in Biology and Medicine with Paul Vasey, and they did a section on sex, gender, and sexual diversity, and there were three papers in there that she was involved with him apparently in choosing, that three of the papers were about transsexuality, and two of them are specifically about autogynephilia, one of them by Anne Lawrence and the other by Bailey, right? So given the fact that she just wrote this supposedly objective critique, you would think that she wouldn't want to come off as being biased, right? And so maybe, like, if she was being a guest editor, that she would choose to, like, I don't know, if I was in her position, I would choose to either ignore the issue because it's a relatively minor issue in trans politics, with the exception of the fact that there's this controversy about it. It's something that hasn't really been taken seriously among a lot of gatekeepers and sexologists, right? Or, you know, Dreger could have, you know, maybe had done one article and picked someone who could do an objective thing showing pros and cons of it, right? Or maybe she could have had two articles, you know, one pro autogynephilia, one against, and that would have made her seem like, oh yeah, she really is being objective here. But she wasn't. She wasn't even, it's like she doesn't even care what people think, right? yeah, she just has one by Bailey and one by Lawrence, right? And, you know, that whole thing kind of makes me think about that one passage where she talks about Andrew James delighted that blah, 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 when she said something, like, about her satire of Bailey. And, you know, I don't know what was going through Alice Dreger's mind when she decided that, oh, it would be great to have, you know, one article by Lawrence and one article by Bailey, you know, in this article, I'm guess editing, but it almost sounds like something, like, I could almost imagine her delighting in that, like, you know, it's just like, you know, I'd like to think that that isn't the case, but it's just, like, so over the top that someone who's trying to be objective on one hand would do something that's so clearly over the top biased in another way. You know, there's a couple more things. You know, she really tries to paint herself as being objective, but I don't really believe that she was objective. For example, her work with ISNA, while in many ways intersex and transsexual activism share a history in which activist voices have been regularly dismissed and erased by medical and scientific establishment authority figures who, in the eyes of society, are deemed to be the real experts on this issue. And so there's no way, forgive me, there's no way she could have just forgotten about all that during her investigation into this, right? You know, there's no way that, you know, I think it's impossible that she, you know, wouldn't make any kind of connections or parallels between the way in which, you know, psychological gatekeepers have institutional power over transsexuals and not draw comparisons to how a lot of the medical establishment has institutional power over intersex people. I think that she purposely discounted it. Similarly, she's a bioethicist, which is a field that constantly asks questions regarding what responsibilities do those engaging in science have. And yet she fails to take Bailey to task for his misuse of his scientific credentials and the fact that he misrepresented his book as science. In fact, she really poo-poos the idea that it was ever pushed as a book on science, and she's like, oh, he wrote it more like a science journalist, when in reality, he positioned himself as a scientist and an expert and an authority on transsexuality throughout it. I don't think she overlooked this. I think she purposely discounted it. And again, I think that a lot of this heavy-handedness, I'm not going to, let's say this. I think that the reason why she did it is I think she wanted to tell the story in a really uncomplicated way. I think she really, you know, I've heard some people suggest that she was just trying to get back at Andrew James. I've heard other people suggest that she seriously, you know, thought that some really bad shit was going down and she wanted to shine a light on it. Either way, regardless of which of those it was, in order to do that in the way that she wanted to do it, she totally had to play down trans people's perspectives, and to totally disregard really important issues that I've brought up throughout this whole recording and in my commentary. She had to discount a lot of stuff. She had to really portray things in a really biased and unobjective way. If I was Archives of Sexual Behavior, or the editor of it, if I was the journal itself, if Ken Zucker stepped down and I was invited to be the editor of that journal, not only would it be a completely different journal than it is now, but I never would have accepted her paper. It's obvious she had an axe to grind. It's obvious that she wanted to show what she wanted to show, and she ignored details that complicated her thesis. While she's completely entitled to her opinions, what she's written is not objective, and it barely even pretends to be. And it's so personal and one-sided that I don't think it should have been in a scientific journal, or at least not portrayed as an article. You know, could have been an opinion piece or something like that. If ASB, you know, being that they did make the choice to publish it, they should have at least called it an opinion piece, or asked someone of equal stature, like on the other side of the debate, to conduct their own investigation in scholarly history, right? But they didn't. And so her article is going out there, and my commentary and other people's commentaries will too. So anyway, I'm pretty much done now. I just want to end with one last Alice Stryker quote, because this one I think is pretty classic. So this is, "In Defense of Reading Papers at Conferences" is the name of the blog post, and this is a little excerpt from it. Quote, "I was reading the 24 commentaries written in response to my tome on the history of the Bailey Book controversy, and so many scholars had so many basic facts wrong, it just made me nuts. Still does. I'll say so in my formal response. I can't believe that professional scholars can be that sloppy when it comes to publishing work in a scholarly journal. I mean, don't they care? Historians do. As a group, we are sticklers for accuracy, for evidence, for documentation." End quote. So, I figured that was a good way to end this recording, which takes issue with the idea that Drager is a stickler for accuracy. And I do have to say that, like her, if my commentary was one of the 24 commentaries that made her nuts, I'd have to say that her paper made me pretty nuts too. And so, you know, after her tome on the history of the Bailey Book controversy, I appreciate you listening to my recording audio tome of my critique of Alice Drager's article. And that's it. Have a wonderful night.